Hitting revenue targets is hard and requires constant hustle. Last quarter's success is already forgotten. Learn the mindset and tactics of today's most successful revenue producers in B2B marketing and sales. We call this the revenue hustle. I'm your host, Tom Hessen, navigating you on this journey. Today's show is sponsored by 9Lenses, an interactive assessment platform that enables you to add instant value to your buyers and allows your sales team to tailor business conversations focused on the pain points each and every time. Check them out at 9Lenses.com. All right, this is your host, Tom Hessen of the Revenue Hustle Podcast, and we're back with another episode. And it is my distinct pleasure to welcome Sanjay Verma to the Revenue Hustle. Sanjay, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Yes, I'm excited to have you here as well. So you are currently the managing director at Alex Partners and the global leader of the digital innovation practice. So introduce yourself. Tell us a little bit about what you're up to.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me here, Tom. So Alex Partners is a global management consulting firm. We have 35 offices globally. We work a lot with small, medium-sized, and even large companies to help them in performance improvement. Now, Alex Partners started with a background of managing through disruptions, managing through through the change that happens because of bankruptcy. But that penchant for speed, that real distinctiveness to get things done fast with small teams really has stood the test of time, as we have been a management consulting firm now for 40 years. And today we help clients across the industries to get the results they're seeking faster, better, with more surety. So glad to be here, as I said. And as part of my role, I manage global our digital innovation service line. And in that service line, we help our clients go beyond the first step of performance improvement, which a lot of times is on cost and then productivity. But then you talk about new things. How do you grow? How do you find new markets? How do you find new revenue? And that's where my role comes in. And really glad to be talking about that today.
Awesome. Yeah, I'm really excited. Well, you know how we do this on the Revenue Hustle. We have revenue rules. So go ahead and give us your first revenue rule.
So Tom, the first revenue rule I have is find the 10x gap. And the reason I talk about that is it's a very critical way to think about and filter opportunities. It's a way to focus. It's a way to find out where you can make a huge difference with the market versus being a me too or a slightly better offer. And that's where these products and services have to be designed that in mind.
So the rule is you're trying to find a product or service where you're 10 times better, let's say, right? That concept of you've got a major lead. Is that right?
Yes, that is exactly right. Now, let me give you a few examples, things have to be 10 times better. And what does it mean? It's not a new rule. It's a Silicon Valley rule. That's what the VCs use when they talk about, should I fund you or not? So what they're really asking is, consider all of the next best alternatives. Consider all of the competition in the market and think about whether what you produce is so much better that might even lead to migrations and conversions. And I'll give you an example here. So one of the first companies I worked with, and we all have formative years, right? So my formative year was one of the companies called Times 10. And you may ask, Times 10? Literally, that is 10 times better than the competition. It was a company that was started in competition with Oracle databases. And this is now 25 years ago. And the company focused on creating main memory, in-memory databases that are 10 times faster in performance than Oracle. Now, what that leads to is, even with that, you can go fight and capture market share in new applications, new areas, because there people are starting from scratch. Where the problem really happens is if you do a direct attack in the core areas where Oracle succeeds. So, and this lesson can be taken to other industries.
Right.
But if you go after an incumbent, which is working and go after their core area of expertise, it's very hard for clients to migrate out into your products. You have to be very thoughtful about, is it a flank attack? It is an attack in new areas. And that's where 10x plus that gives you a starting point. Now, if you're so good, can you start the transition from the core? If you do that, you have a winner like, Palo Alto Networks, you have a winner
Right.
like Zscaler, and you become really big.
Got it. And so how did you, so was that your first experience with kind of this concept of being 10x better than your competition? Like
No, that's
how did
right.
you, yeah, how'd you kind of shape this view?
So this view comes in now 30 years in the valley, having seen all sorts of companies come and go. Some have succeeded, just to be clear, even without a 10x gap. So not that this rule is the only rule, but the first startup I started working with was TimesTen, which actually finally was bought by Oracle in 2005. But 8 years of working very hard to differentiate and prove ourselves against Oracle, which was the incumbent, the behemoth, the largest
Right,
database
right,
provider out
right.
there, honed the thinking about and the experience, right? Not just the thinking, the sales process. And you find what clients are really looking forward to. Where will they change versus not? Where are they receptive to your ideas about a product? It really comes back to being so clear on the value prop that it really makes a difference. And then it's been now 20 years plus of management consulting, helping companies not only do performance optimization, but find new areas for M&A, find growth. It has become more and more clear as we have helped our clients, you really want to look for that step out value prop. Otherwise, I have myself personally been in so many situations where a leader, a BU leader, a product leader will come and talk quite optimistically about the revenue growth that's coming. And then when you get into it, what is the value prop being delivered? You don't find the 10x. And then you step back and look at the history and correlate what you saw versus what happened. And you start seeing that pattern repeating itself, where the clients and the companies which were able to very clearly state the 10x ended up typically succeeding, and the ones which couldn't had a harder time creating that that revenue growth that we are all looking for.
Yeah, and I think that's so you first hear it in the value prop, because that's really just a way, like if your story, if your value prop is not that differentiated or that transformative, disruptive, like whatever word you want to kind of use, it is a, it's not just an incremental 10% improvement, right? This is a major step, right? And that's what you're looking for as a business leader, because they're right, 10% is great, but right, you're never going to move the needle at that pace. Right.
And if I just add to you, right, this comes from again core versus non-core products, right? Where let's look at a 10% improvement. Let's look at situation where an ERP is there, whether it's SAP or let's say Oracle database. You can pick any of these situations. What happens is if your product is 10% better, it has to go through two things. One, is it 10% better for the activities under scope, but to finish the activity from start to end, the client or the user spends 100 units, and this is only 10 units. Even if you make it a little bit better, you took 100 units of work down to what, 95, even if you're twice as better as the competition, that hardly moves the needle for that overall activity. So you need to look at the scope and not just think about I'm so much better in this one area, but from an end user perspective, from a business value delivery perspective, did I move the needle for the client? And then the second complexity that happens when you look at ERP or Oracle or any of these things is they are so much in the center. The cost to rip out is not just that you replace the database or you replace the ERP. Both of those probably have 90 dependencies and downstream and
Right.
upstream applications, which have to be rewritten to now connect with your system, which nobody has the time for. So both there is a big hump in terms of that cost to transform. And second, did you really make a difference? So until you are in a 10x zone, what starts happening is, even a product which thinks of service that I'm 2x better feels like I can get it, like I'm so much better, I can get it done. But when you throw in all of these environmental issues
Right.
on top, it's very difficult for companies to move. And this again is based on now 30 years of experience working with products and services. And that 10x is at least a starting point that you clear that bar. Now there is a way to talk about that product and service which will resonate with the clients and which can change things. That's why it's a revenue rule that we should put in front of our mind and say, are we making a step change for our clients?
Right. It's a bar, it's a measurement stick, right? To think about like our ideas, our approach, when we, you know, because you're right, there's a lot of, you know, companies are designed to almost do nothing because it takes so much inertia to drive change, both from the outside, but also our internal stakeholders, right? It just takes so much political capital, money, time, effort that what is it in, you know, like what's it for, right? So they need to do that for something that's going to move the needle, right? Like that's
No,
really.
exactly. And I'll give you one more example from experience here. As we, one of the part of the pieces of work I've done is designed a new educational technology and a tech system that I was doing in the previous job. And we use that yardstick, right? Where is that 10x acceleration, 10x change that we are bringing to the market? And the thing that we really thought about is when you go in the corporate education market and think about how people get trained and what they end up doing, a lot of it has been traditionally you have an L&D department
Right.
which designs 10, 15, maybe 25 learning pathways. And the whole company of thousands of tens of thousands of people follows one of those 10 or 20 learning pathways. So you can see that in today's world where marketing is getting hyper, let's say, segmented and personalized, education has and corporate training has been a little bit far behind. So when we designed this, we said we need to rethink this whole process. And ultimately, delivery of videos and delivery of training content is the same. That's not where you can innovate. It's a video, it's a video. You deliver it
Right,
like you
right.
do. But where can we make a 10x difference? So we designed a system which took on all sorts of data from LinkedIn and other places to think about what is a job profile, how do we extract their current skills based on their resumes, not by giving them 100 tests, but looking at what they say they have been able to do in the past, match that up against what people require as skills, and how do those skills change in time based on job descriptions. So now you have a way to say, you are here. This is the type of a pathway you should follow. And then you can take those skills and automatically connect with content from thousands of resources, whether it's Coursera or, you know, all these
Right.
other providers. And then when you put it together, now you can self-assemble, AI assemble essentially, learning pathways individually tailored to who you are and where you want to go. And of course, you apply and give the client or the customer here, the user, an ability to change things as they need. But that's an idea that did not exist and still has not been executed out in the market. And it changes the game in terms of delivery of content. So that's just an idea about how you take one part of it and think about what's so new. And that's what we think about taking to our clients when we talk to our clients. What is that big delta with which we know that we can deliver on this change that we want in our in terms of our products and services?
So yeah, so now I mean it's very clear, and you obviously talk to your clients. I mean, you're in the innovation practice, right? So you're talking about this with your clients. How hard is it to find or help your clients find this sort of 10x step up with their a new product, an existing product, right? Like how do you help them navigate that, and how easy is it to find? I imagine it's not easy to repeat this, right? Or
So
you'd be the best
that's
VC in the world, right?
exactly. So you are in exactly right place. VCs try to do this day in, day out, and not all of them are succeeding and returning 50, 60, 100% returns on their portfolio. Imagine doing that in a corporate setting. It is 10, in fact, it's 10x as hard for the corporates to
Right.
actually deliver in this process. Because a lot of corporate work, as you rightly pointed out, is optimizing what we have. I have a $10 billion machine. If I can make it $10.5 billion next year, that sounds pretty good. With 2% more in margin or 5% more in EBITDA. And the market actually values that and returns and your market price and your value will go up. So the setting is not really for you to do something that is very far from your comfort zone, represents a magnitude of risk that nobody knows how to really think about. So there are, you know, a few ways to think. There is no, I would say, silver bullet that answers this very quickly. But whenever you are innovating on your product, if you're innovating on your product and service and going where you usually go, I think that's where you keep your current incremental mentality because you have to, it's a big engine. But when you start launching new products and services, I think that's where you have to think hard about, will my brand be enough for me to get market share, or do I really need something else? And there have been situations in the past, as we all know, Microsoft and Office is a great case example where the bundle and the brand was able to move things forward compared to others. So there is something about a large mothership which allows you to do a lot of things. But being cognizant about it and being careful about it, even especially in new products and services, is critical. And one other way clients do it is they literally launch a new, a new venture. And that's part of what we do as a service line. We are partnering with a company called Nax, and we help clients launch a new venture, which sometimes can be fully funded, partially funded, but it's outside the mothership, which allows that innovation to really go. And if it grows and it proves itself, then the company can always acquire it back. So there are a couple of ways to kind of think through
Interesting.
this.
No, that's really good because I think it really helps to evaluate what products do you invest in and which ones you don't, right? Like, and there should be a pretty high bar to invest in these initiatives if it's not going to give, there's risk in everything, but you might as well shoot for the stars. You know, if you're going to spend, you know, X amount of dollars on an initiative, it should give you a lot of headroom for growth, right? Like,
Absolutely, Tom. I mean, this again, 30 years of doing this, I've run into several cases where the management is quite convinced we can make a difference. But if you apply your 10x gap, you apply your 10x gap in customer experience or value delivery, it feels incremental, right? And incremental changes do not bring extraordinary market share changes. And that is just hard. People haven't thought through this. They haven't internalize this, and that's part of our job is to bring those case examples, show the difference so that clients start understanding that they have to think harder about what is that unfair advantage they're using to create that delta. So,
yeah.
yeah, very true.
No, this is great because I mean it's very thought-provoking, right? I mean it's not just a you know, it's not a simple formula, right? But it really does like like the measuring stick is the best thing I can think of, but that we should think about how we measure our ideas to that rule and are we ambitious enough, right? Because I bet you've run into companies where they're not ambitious enough. You're like, you sure you don't want to shoot for the moon a little bit more, right? And maybe there's some companies where they're, you know, do you find that their companies are not or less risk, like they're risk averse, and you have to kind of encourage them to be bolder?
No, Tom, that's exactly right. There is this whole issue that ultimately a company is going to measure, quote unquote, its risk-adjusted returns. And when you look at risk-adjusted returns, as I said, if you have a $10 billion revenue, a 5% difference is 500 million. Sounds pretty good. And if it comes from slight adjustment of sales territories, a slight adjustment in your advertising funnel, which does lead generation, great. I will invest the 5 million to create the 500 million because I have line of sight to how to make it happen. So again, those are good things, and the clients and the companies have to do them, right? There is no reason why you wouldn't optimize your current engine. But this is where, as you think about growth, as you think about growth in areas which are outside of what you were doing, right? So you're going after products and services where other incumbents exist. Now the question is, does your current market position translate directly into a very favorable market position in a new market? Or really, you really need to think about that 10x rule. And some of this, as an example, if you think about SharePoint, right, that came and shook the market, and they were one of the fastest products to get to $1 billion in revenues when billion was a big thing. I think it's starting to not be a very big thing nowadays. It's a billion is the new million. But if you go back, there was a lot of work where that team really rethought what is collaboration, how do you exchange documents, and SharePoint team did an amazing job to bring a new product which didn't exist while it's just an extension, but it was not a slight change. And trying to think about those 10x in the context of the companies you are at and the work you're doing is important. A lot of our work ends up being clients asking us to completely rethink the value chains. So we end up exercising 10x quite a bit more than what I think a typical customer
Right.
or client would do. But this is how you have to differentiate. Where are you in this value chain and which one is a more important rule?
Yeah, no, that's great. All right, so let's transition to our second revenue rule. Why don't you share that with us?
So the second revenue rule for me is really only paranoid survives. And now, just to be very fair and honest about it, it is Andy Grove's rule, not my rule. But it's a really good one. And having grown up in the valley and having seen stops, ups and downs from BlackBerries to AltaVista and others, people who have not been paranoid sometimes have shown a tendency to not grow and to sometimes just be gone and disappear. So it's a very frightening rule. It sounds frightening, but
Right.
it's also very energizing. We'll go into the depth of it, but that's my second one.
So yeah, so I mean, a couple things come to mind, right? The paranoid is that you're never comfortable, right? You're always looking around, your head's on a swivel, right? There are camps that say, I don't worry about my competitors. I'm just trying to do what is best for my clients and my business, and I don't care what features or functions or offerings that our competitors are doing, because I don't want to be a me too product anyway, right? So it just kind of it's a feature race, and now all of a sudden, nobody wins that, right? So I'm curious, just kind of as you talk about that, just share a little bit about the like what that means, to be paranoid.
So Tom, a really, really good question, by the way, because this is not about copying your competition, but to me, it really couples with the, finding the 10x gap and why. Like I'll explain why. So you absolutely have to focus on delivering very good value to your customers and your clients, for sure. They are paying you, and it's almost your fiduciary duty to make sure they get good
Right.
value out of the products and services that you're delivering to them, certainly. But this is where I will bring in the innovator's dilemma concepts that the more comfortable you get in doing just what you're doing, what you have to watch out for is, I have a core customer set. Is it shrinking? Is it growing? Your revenue may not show it for a while, by the way, because you can always charge more if you're delivering good value to your current customers. But is it growing or is it shrinking? If it's shrinking, typically that's where the problem starts, because your products and your service, your framework, is that compatible? Is that riding the wave of growth and trends that are happening in the market? So, for example, today, if you don't have GenAI, you're not thinking about how GenAI makes a difference to your products and service, you are going to be
Right.
behind because everybody else is. If 3 years ago, or 3 years ago, you were not thinking about AI in general, 10 years ago, you were not thinking about cloud, that's where major changes have happened. And you can pick anything, right? Palo Alto Networks made a big pivot to cloud probably 5 to 7 years ago, and it's showing the results right now. It's growing like crazy. Companies like Informatica have gone through a series of changes, and the latest change towards cloud, towards subscription, really turbocharged growth back for them. So it's about not just, hey, do I have a competition and do I need to copy? It's about, is the competition getting to a point where I can extrapolate and see that they will replace me in some segments?
Right.
And if you follow that innovator's dilemma logic, the base segment goes away first, but you still have your high-end segment. So I'm going to focus there. But then the low end of the high-end segment goes away. And slowly
Right,
you are
right,
steel
right.
with no customers left. So it's really paranoid, not because of every feature and every small, bell and whistle. Paranoid as to, do you see a path that the competition and the trends that are coming up will displace you? So it
Right.
is head on the swivel, like you said, but it's to watch out for what are the threats to the existence of the company, not 5% market share here or there, but
Right.
the existence, which then goes back to the 10x. And you really have to think about how are you delivering on the latest trends and the latest things that are changing in the market.
Yeah. Now, yeah, I mean, because you think about like, what's the threat to the company? It's usually not your competitor, right? There's always a mar like, that's your point. It's a market share game, right? So something introduces a 10x gap, right, improvement that may be coming out of left field. It could be a startup, it could be, a big company like Microsoft investing in OpenAI or whatever it may be that nobody quite anticipated. And, some trends you can see, others you may not be able to as quickly, from adjacent markets and so on. But I think that's your point, is you just have to be attentive. You can't be asleep at the wheel. You have to be out
No,
there.
that's right. See, you look at some case examples which are easy and everybody will relate to. BlackBerry was an amazing company that was built to deliver very, very interesting value prop. And we all have been. I've been a BlackBerry user for the longest time. And I only moved to iPhone at version 4. I couldn't just figure out why I need it. But when you step back and think about it, I think BlackBerry was a little slower in responding to the threat that iPhone represented. And not just them, it's many other phone providers like Sony. I loved the Sony before I had a BlackBerry. But then they had some memory limitations which they never got over. It's really just looking at and saying, this new product, not a threat to me, not my segment. It's saying, how could it be a threat to me? Even if I don't believe it, if I do a little bit of a leap of faith and projection, can this change the game? And being watchful for these threats that can very quickly change how things work. I mean, Sony is another example, with Sony being master of all consumer electronics when
Right.
we were afraid in the US that it'll be all Sony and nothing else. And things change very rapidly, very quickly. Just being on a watch for that. And not being comfortable and waking up worrying about what is everybody else doing, not yet just direct competition, all these new startups and new companies, the
Right.
10xers who are around me, and being watchful is what I think is critical for long-term success.
So, I think of like Blockbuster and Netflix, right? Or there's a lot of or Kodak and film and digital cameras and so on. Those are the classic stories. Now, whose job is it to be the paranoid one, right? Like that doesn't fall into anyone's, I'm curious. Like maybe someone's job is like chief strategy officer or somebody like that. But who's out there? How do companies do this?
That is a hard question. I think it's a very astute question here, Tom. It's traditionally not been any one particular role's job. And the problem is the signals come in so many different ways
Right.
that can you expect the chief product officer to worry about this? No, because they're so focused on creating the roadmap and the thousands of features they manage and the allocation of resources that needs to happen to deliver to current large customers and maybe some new segments. If you're a revenue chief revenue officer, you're very much worried about meeting the numbers quarter to quarter, especially for public companies. So it feels like, but they are getting the signals. They're in the client conversations. In a sense, this is the chief executive officer's job to worry about what is everybody else doing. Now, given their role, can they be in detail everywhere? It's probably hard. But the roles that may be a natural fit is sort of a chief strategy officer because you're a little removed from day to day,
Right.
but you are at the executive level, you are listening to everybody else. And then you can get those signals. You can look at the numbers. You can look at and you will have the authority in the role to go do some deep dives to see where the numbers are not up to expectations, where the win rates are lower than you thought they should be.
Right.
And that could be a little bit of those, ears and brain that a CEO will need. But I think the back of your mind, it's almost like you have to have a little bit of space for this so that one of your trusted lieutenants can bring it back. But it's really hard. It's not easy.
Yeah, because like you said, the machine is just designed to operate, and even if you were to spot them, you may discount them, right? Like that's happened a bunch too. It's not for the lack of seeing it, but they didn't recognize that it had the ability to take
And
them out.
absolutely, Tom, and have been in the middle of many of these conversations where, and I'll just talk industry level. This is where I cannot and will not take names, but look at the print industry as an example, right? We have had leaders who created those categories. I mean, those didn't exist 40 years ago, and these leaders, and amazingly bright individuals created those industries from scratch, but the digital threat they were slow to realize and slow to hop onto. And then we have seen these companies and behemoths of the technology industry struggle, as an example, over the last, I would say, 10, 15 years, as the screens have become retina screens. So it's just as good as paper. I mean, it's
Right.
beautiful printouts, beautiful screens. So you don't print things anymore. So what is the role of these companies going forward? Or the, or the rise of cloud providers. So when you look at the whole infrastructure market, and this is like 15 years ago, I was saying this is so when you really look at what happened in the cloud space, if you really boil it down to something very simple, it was the emergence of very large buyers. And in any industry where the buying power starts getting concentrated into five, three, 10 players, that industry will shrink in margin. I mean, this is something I think the human society has learned over the last hundreds of years. Anytime you have very, very large buyers, those large buyers are not paying the same as everybody else.
Right.
So when you are left with Walmart and Amazon, or in the cloud industry, it was Microsoft, I mean, Azure, AWS, and others, what you're stuck with is that the value pools will shrink for others and they will start going towards where the power is. And that has happened in all these industries. So
Right.
it's really realizing all of this, being aware of all these changes so that you can foresee and see how you will navigate and create an enduring organization that will sustain. That's where this comes in. Because you may be very successful today, but 3 years later, 5 years later, do you still expect the same situation? Or do you have to change things? Do you
Right.
have to disrupt yourself? And Apple was one of the, I think, classic companies, which, especially when Steve Jobs came back, a series of disruptions to themselves, and they were not afraid to do it. But those decisions and those risks are of gutsy calls. And sometimes not all companies can do it because the
Right.
culture is different, ownership structure is different. But that's where the paranoid portion comes in, if that's making sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, this is great. I mean, a lot of I feel like we're in the C-suite conversation here. I mean, which is great because these are different types of growth levers that we've talked about than we've talked about in the past. So I think this is, I mean, I can see why you're a management consultant. So and do very well, right? I mean, these are conversations and topics I'm sure your clients don't think about every day, which is why you do so well. So tell us a little bit about how you got into consulting.
Great question. It's been growing up, I have to say, a little bit, and this is now going maybe 40 years back in time. But McKinsey, of course, and BCG are well-known names in the industry globally. They were even 40 years ago, McKinsey especially. And Rajat Gupta was the CEO at that time. And that was big splash of news everywhere in India as I grew up. So more and more, I learned about and understood what management consulting does and the intellectual challenge of it and the satisfaction of making real contribution. To so many sort of critical top clients, it's just quite energizing. So that was sort of behind why I ended up. Now, first 10 years, I developed products. I love technology equally, if not more. So I always say I'm an engineer first, a consultant later, because engineering has been my passion and love creating software. In fact, that's one of the reasons I was in a tech company initially. We talked about TimesTen. But from TimesTen, I moved to McKinsey. And the challenge of looking at all parts of the company's growth, bringing these type of revenue roles over time into how we think about products and services and growth strategies has been quite fulfilling. I mean, that's sort of why I ended up in the last 20
Sure.
years has been in management consulting.
Well, that's awesome. And yeah, I know you've worked with some pretty prestigious firms and AlixPartners is certainly one of them as well. And thank you for coming on here. Where can we follow you online?
So to follow me online, LinkedIn is a great place. That's where I'm active. I will tell the website. It is, of course, linkedin.com/in/SanjayVarmaIITK. So that's a great place to find me, or just search Sanjay Verma Alix Partners. I'm sure you will land with me. Very happy to connect with everybody and talk to them, and certainly happy to just, share my experiences, and hopefully that'll be useful for people.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for coming on to the show. This has been a great conversation. I've got a page full of notes here, so I'm going to go off and start thinking about my 10x gap value prop and see if it measures up here. So you've given me a lot to think about, and as well as our audience. So thank you, Sanjay. Let's do it again soon.
Thank you so much, Tom. That was a pleasure talking through these and revisiting some of the memories. Happy to talk anytime.
Sounds good. Take care.
You too.
Thank you for tuning in to The Revenue Hustle. This episode has been brought to you by 9Lenses. Close more deals with interactive assessments. Check them out at 9Lenses.com. See you next time.